Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
March 14, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this, indeed, is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, it is Monday, Moonday, the first broadcast day of the week at O'Shelly.com, and therefore the first broadcast day of the week for the O'Shelly Effect. Of course, many of you will be capturing this later on, further on down the stream by your Fondle Cyber of choice, your applicable application and your podcatcher du jour, because it is a podcast that does survive long after I'm done talking and anybody else I bring on the show. So we normally have these regular guests on Mondays, but I did suspend Mondays for a bit due to the other network carrying my show temporarily and all that good stuff, and that's all done. So we are back to full speed because they fired me. Why did they fire me? Okay. They fired me because, I had a bit of sympathy for people that are being victimized by the action going on in Ukraine. That's the bottom line. My first guest on that network show was somebody who lives in Ukraine to tell us what's going on the ground. Oops. I guess that's not what you're supposed to do. I guess you're not supposed to try and tell, well, other sides of the story outside of what it is that RT approves of. Well, at least according to those guys. Anyway, enough about them, enough about that, because I've got a special guest on tonight. Not my regular people, not at all. Who did I turn to? J.G. Michael himself, Parallax Views, of course, the co-host of Failed State Update, and rightfully so, a guy that I'm always happy to talk to, a guy I'm always happy to discuss things with off the air, J.G. Michael. Why? Because even though he's a bit oriented differently than myself, that was a sloppy sentence, but either way, even though he is a bit different from me when it comes to political things, him and I do tend to converge at certain points and agree on a lot. So maybe he's a bit more on the left than I am, just a touch, but not so much. He tells me, and I'm telling him, I'm struggling to have someone to logically, reasonably, rationally discuss what's going on in Ukraine, outside of my friends in Ukraine, who are at this moment somewhat busy. Okay, guess why? Anyway, thing is, I need somebody to maybe educate me here. Maybe tell me something I don't know. Maybe tell me something that I'm not seeing, I'm not observing, because I'll tell you what. The problem here, as far as this entire issue goes, in my opinion, is a whole bunch of virtue signaling. What are the problems? Well, the wonderful MSM corporate media in America has actually gotten on a proper moral side, in a way, saying that horrible things happen to people in war. I'm almost shocked because, generally speaking, they ignore that no matter who the culprit is, no matter who the victim is. It just seems to be, you know, the open-air video game and the ratings grab, which, by the way, they're benefiting mightily at the moment. Take a look at CNN's recovery and how many viewers they have live all day long with their coverage. Do I sound bitter? I'm not. I knew this was coming. And then you have the, the right-wing media, and they do what they do. And they are vacillating back and forth almost like a fan. You know, one of those fans you buy that kind of, what do they call that? I guess vacillation is a pretty good thing to say, but what is it? It rotates back and forth in a semicircle so that the wind gets blown around. Anyways, they're going back and forth between, yes, indeed, the war is rough, but also poor Putin and how he's been encircled and how, okay. Is there some validity to that? Perhaps. But is there also validity to the propaganda being directly put out by Russian sympathetic media assets? I don't know. I'll tell you this. For the most part, if you're looking at those three corridors of media power, you're not getting the whole story. I know that much. And I'll tell you what else. On the other hand, there's this thing we call alt media. Okay, the allegedly independent, allegedly alternative, and yes, I got to use the word allegedly a lot, media, and some of them right on board with either Putin's talking points, or they've gone full on into the, I don't know, the Joe Biden wonderland, where this is terrible, we're going to do sanctions, but we're not going to do anything because we don't want World War III to happen, And that's about it in a nutshell. Either way, I don't see anybody blazing a trail or getting at the truth or getting at the reality. So tall order for my friend that I have on here. I hope my friend anyway, after this discussion that JG recommended to bring on. His name's Alex. And you know what? He's a lot more than just some guy named Alex. And I'd like him to introduce himself to you guys since this is his first time on the show. And that's quite enough out of this loudmouth guy from the East Coast of what we used to call America. So, Alex, I know I made you sit through a couple of minutes of introduction here, but I think it was necessary, and I am anxiously awaiting a discussion with you where I hope to learn and hope to educate my listeners a bit about, I don't know, some reality as opposed to the constant flow of fiction coming from the propaganda outlets. And no, I don't see how donating money to the Ukrainians through everything that somebody's telling me to do, because my software is telling me to do it, okay? The people I pay for different services to run this network, they're asking me, do I want to donate money to the Ukraine? YouTube's asking me, okay? Everybody's asking me, do I want to donate money? Sure, I would love to if I thought it would get to some of those people. But at this very moment, is anything going to help the people that are suffering that did not sign up for this? Oh, I'm sorry. I do have an anti-war position, by the way, Alex. Just so you know, I'm one of those guys who wishes that we as a species could evolve beyond that. And you've had no warning about any of this. So I appreciate your time, your patience, your indulgence, sir. So let's start off first by asking you how you're doing. And tell us, in case nobody's ever heard of you before, how is it that you would introduce yourself? So go for it, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on. So yeah, my name's Alex Gendler. I'm a writer, editor of various things. I've done some educational videos for TED. I've got an article in American Affairs, kind of all over the place. But the main reason I'm here today is because, aside from being all those things, I am originally from Kharkiv, Ukraine. Was the Soviet Union back then. Just a bit about my background. My family's Russian-speaking Jewish family. I was born in Soviet Ukraine, went to 2 years of Soviet school, and we left in 91, right about when shit started hitting the fan, so to speak. Which, you know, we had no idea how much shit would hit the fan. But sorry, am I allowed to actually...
Normally... It's okay. Normally, I ask people not to do that, but my brother, you speak any which way you want tonight, right? Okay? Go ahead.
That's a bit of my background. In Kharkiv, which I was pretty happy for it to be a little-known city. It is the second largest city in Ukraine, although probably not anymore, because as far as last I know, about half the population has fled. It's been under the heaviest shelling by the Russians. That's my sort of connection to this. I'm also not just some guy that, you know, came here as a kid and then is trying to jump on the bandwagon. I did go back several times, starting from shortly before the Maidan Revolution in 2013. And then I went back two more times in 2015, 2016. So I have quite a few contacts and friends there, and as well as old family friends. That's that.
Great. That gives us a real lens into your personal history. But you're also apparently somebody who knows how to speak if you're giving TED Talks. You're somebody who is an educator and a journalist, so let's slap a couple of labels on you. Sorry for that, but sure. Let's do it. And understand that you're a guy who is very considerate, let's say, of the multiple and multi-layered issues here. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw a brick on our little conversational table, okay, mm-hmm. And it's going to land with a thud. And I appreciate your patience and indulgence to begin with, but here's the thing that somebody tried to force into my mouth, okay? I mean that directly. Somebody wanted me to speak to this point and make this point. This is not, I say again, for anybody listening or deciding to take this out of context, this is not my opinion. Understand. This is not what I believe exactly. Although, I have seen it reported by many people as their opinion. And I'm not sure where from they got it, but anyway. Thing is this. The general attitude when this invasion started, and the first thing that, and by the way, I have a contention with that alone, because the invasion, in my opinion, began in 2014.
It did, yes.
And has been in slow motion, so to speak, since then. So therefore, this idea that it just happened, you know, what, 10 days ago now, is absolute nonsense. This has been a continuing process, and it just really got turned up or sped up in the past 10 days, in my opinion. Obviously, there's a greater level of violence there than has been seen in a very long time, and one could not argue that there hasn't been more violence there in the past 10 days than there was, say, in the past 7 years. However, the idea and the thing that was thrust upon me, which was supposed to be my opinion if I was to toe the line, was that, well, the Ukrainian government is so entirely corrupt and full of Nazis, you understand, that we should be siding with Putin, who is protecting Russians, who have been the targets of these Ukrainian Nazi corrupt people, who have been committing a genocide against them. And indeed, they fired first upon Russians, okay, whether they were within the borders of their territory or they were on the edge of their territory. These people literally fired the first shots. And Putin is now defending people. In fact, the translations from what I can understand from some Russian media, which I've gotten my hands on, the idea that they are liberators, okay, moving into Ukraine at a quick pace and bringing all sorts of military assets in and all that over the past 10 days or so. And I'm not trying to sound insensitive here. I'm just telling you what's been thrust upon me as the opinion I'm supposed to have. Okay, as an indie media, alt media person, that's it. That this is justifiable. So, I throw this on the table as if it were a physical brick. There's the thud. Now, talk to me about this and tell me what part of this you think is well, relevant, realistic. Propaganda. I mean, please parse it out as best you can for me. Just that initial contention, please.
Yeah. I mean, let's take this brick apart. I mean, I will say it's, I'm not even going to like look for the kernel of truth there, because it's a brick of bullshit. There are other things that I will say later after demolishing this brick that, yes, there's some nuance to complicate it. But I think the important thing to note is, I mean, well, let's start with the first thing, that Ukraine is a corrupt Nazi government, right? First of all, you know, I don't know who Russia is to throw out accusations of being a corrupt government. So let's just get that out of the way immediately. I mean, anyone, like the mind just boggles, like anyone who has read anything about post-Soviet Russia, whether in the 90s or under Putin, when he kind of consolidated the oligarchs into one faction, it's essentially synonymous with corruption. So let's just get that out of the way first. In terms of it being a Nazi government, we've all know anyone who follows left or anti-war or indie media at this point has been inundated with images of the Azov Battalion. We all know about those guys, right? The scary guys with like the neo-Nazi insignia, and the Ukrainian soldiers who are wearing their patches, and is Ukraine just like overrun with Nazis?
Well, they do exist. They do exist.
Yeah, they do.
Alex.
They do.
Yeah,
and absolutely, they do exist, and yes, they're a problem, and it's a problem that has been reported on by even, you know, the quote-unquote pro-Western media. Radio Free Europe, ran an investigation into them. That article is up. Ukraine's own, like, progressive civil society has been trying to reduce their influence. The fact is, these groups are basically mercenaries who are funded by rich oligarchs who do exist in Ukraine as they do in Russia. And they have their own ends and their own sort of incentives. I mean, nobody is benefiting more from the war than those guys. I think it's important to acknowledge that and that they do exist. But the way in which they're brought up in these conversations is just entirely disingenuous. Because, I'll give you one example. How many of these people who bring up the Azov Battalion and bring up the problem of Nazism in Ukraine have even bothered to like look for any sources or ask, well, how do actual Jews who live in Ukraine feel about this, right? How do Ukraine's mm-hmm. actually existing Jewish communities, which, by the way, there are plenty of, how do they feel about this? And what you find, if you look up, there's articles in Haaretz, there's articles everywhere, is that the Ukraine's actual Jewish communities have, by and large, stood by their government, rejected these claims of Russia's coming to liberate and denazify them. They are horrified by the prospect of living under a Russian quote-unquote denazification regime. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that these perspectives, the people who wave around the Azov Battalion are not interested in that, right? They're just interested in advancing a certain narrative at any cost. And so that's the one thing, right? The other thing is how many people have looked at the other side and looked at what the Russian forces are actually made up of. So let's look at the sort of militias fighting on the Russian separatist side in the Donbas. You've got the Russian Orthodox Army, who are associated with the neo-Nazi paramilitary organization Russian National Unity, which, by the way, have a swastika, like a Slavic-looking swastika in their insignia. Correct. You've got the Varyag Battalion, which straight up Germanic neo-Nazi stuff. There was a battalion led by Igor Strelkov, a former FSB officer and a confirmed war criminal who committed war crimes in Bosnia in the 90s. Mm-hmm. There's the Sparta Battalion, also a neo-Nazi battalion. Probably the best known is the Wagner Group, which is like a paramilitary mercenary organization, also just straight up neo-Nazis. So
now this whole list that you just gave us, you're talking right. about Russian cohorts here. This is part of what we're now seeing active in the action in Ukraine. Am I right?
They've been active since 2014. These are the quote unquote people's militias that established basically Russian separatist rule in the Donbas starting from 2014, and who are now fighting on the Russian side in this current war. Yes.
Okay. Next question, because this is a point of clarity that I'm trying to get to, and quite frankly, is not easy to get at. I'm not somebody who apologizes for the actions, the dirty, the criminal activity, in fact, of my own government. And therefore, I have this interesting question about even the one Ukrainian battalion we're talking about in the Nazi sphere. Because remember, that whole list he just gave you for the listener is all the Russian cohorts. But back to the Ukrainian one, since everybody wants to focus there. Their funding, their support may not have just been from Russia. In fact, what I see is evidence, and it's not the evidence that I would take to court at the moment because I can't get a hold of it. But I would say that they were at the very least a useful tool for the West in certain actions here as well. So I'm not certain that there isn't some Western money that's gone into, guess what, supporting the Nazi faction, for lack of a better term. Within the Ukrainian military.
The Ukrainian military gets support from the West. So, yes, as long as the Ukrainian military has units like this integrated into it, they will get some of that, too. That's definitely a problem.
Well, that's a guarantee. Plus, as we always find out, there are always funding streams, let's call them generously, that are fed to useful organizations like this by the United States government, by NATO. This has happened before in many places, and they're not always, you know, the people that you would think that NATO and the U.S. should be supporting. The very, very sort of cloudy trajectory of funding, say, for Al-Qaeda in the past, the Mujahideen. Exactly when did Osama bin Laden become a enemy as opposed to an asset? How much funding was given to Saddam Hussein before it was time to topple his regime? But, you know, those are the headliners. There are tons of different groups which are disruptive and are weaponized and are irrespective of their political orientation or their social status, useful to some of these larger programs in place, especially in the fun and games world of our intelligence community, okay? So in my mind, these people could have been perfectly useful at different points for different reasons and, quite frankly, might still continue to exist given the fact that they are generally supported, even though it may not be the thing that they want to advertise. You know, we're not going to have a sponsored by the, by the Pentagon patch on these guys' uniforms, okay? But indeed, American money and American intelligence assets and all kinds of things could have and do appear to have reasonably been possibly fed to exactly these people as well. So what I'm saying is there's no clean hands here in this situation where it's like, well, I support the idea of destroying Nazis, don't you? Yes, right. I do. I don't think that that should be encouraged anywhere. On the other hand, we well know that the U.S. government has turned around and, well, collected Nazi assets in the past. I mean, World War II, Operation Paperclip is easy. But there are numerous examples where individuals who might not be on board with freedom and democracy have been funded and helped by U.S. assets, U.S. corporate assets, U.S. military assets, U.S. intelligence assets in the past. So I think it's valid to understand that none of this stuff, even as you're discussing it, and even telling us about, yeah, all these other cohorts, again, best word I can come up with, in the Russian sphere, they're being funded by the oligarchs, obviously, because, well, as I've tried to explain on this program several times, the gangster state that is the Russian Federation is exactly that. Basically, people that were criminals were brought into the legitimate government in order to solidify the position for Putin. And I'm not even complaining about it like he's some sort of grand enemy. See, that's the thing. I understand that, quite frankly, the criminal contingent is almost always useful to a government, especially if it is in a rebuilding sort of orientation or a rebuilding, time period in its history. A functional economy sometimes is in the black market, one way or another, and it could be a lot of different things. Turned to that, I think that's exactly a very street level and oversimplified way, maybe. But look, I'm not highly educated. So what I see is that criminals were not just welcomed into the new formation after the fall of the Soviet Empire, but were actually made an integral part of it, financially especially. But they were given seats at the table directly, which was a practical, a pragmatic move. Okay, not even making a moral judgment here by Putin. So I think we should always keep that in mind when we're talking about the great and wonderful intentions of this guy, okay, who has continuously done things that the world has generally ignored when it came to Chechnya, Georgia, the actions that it's taken against other former Baltic states, so on and so forth. So all of this is in context when we're talking about it. But let's get back to the denazification, because that's the bell everybody rings. What do you want to support Nazis? No, I don't. But then again, if people were to simply extract things like this from actions that, say, the U.S. government took, the Russian government has taken, the British government has taken, and on and on and on. The Italians, let's go from my part of my ethnic background. If you take a look at what the governments have turned around and supported, not always on the moral high ground anyway. And fact is, nobody ever has completely clean hands, especially when war happens. Now, I tell me that I'm just crazy and I'm just a dirty hippie. Go ahead.
I mean, nothing you said is wrong. So, basically, especially, I'm on the left like J.G. Michael. And the truth is, really since the fall of the Soviet Union, and actually long before that, because the Soviet Union itself had ceased to be any kind of... there's an argument about when the Soviet Union stopped being socialist. Some people place the line at, you know, 1919. Some people say it was 1956. But regardless, since the fall of the Soviet Union, you basically, the world has a choice between different right-wing regimes. And so you have, you know, neoliberal kind of states like U.S. and its Western allies, or you have straight-up gangster capitalism like Putin. Mm-hmm. So first of all, there's really, like, on a purely ideological level, there's really no side to cheer for there, right? So I'm glad to grant that. But in terms of, like, the realities of people on the ground, and it's generally been the case that people from the former communist states, you know, like, that wasn't a decision that was, like, made from the top. Like, in people forget this. Like, in from, like, 1989 to 1991... people rose up all over the Eastern Bloc. Right. And, you know, we can now kind of condescendingly say, oh, they didn't know what they were getting into. They were just fighting for, you know, this exploitative kind of capitalism that's, you know, and a lot of those countries are not that well off now. But generally, people still agree that they're better off now than they were. You know, that's different within Russia itself. But people in Poland, people in the Baltic states, and people in Ukraine do not want to go back under Russia's thumb, and for good reason, especially when you look at the kind of regime they've been running. Ukraine has been a struggling, corrupt state with its own problems with nationalism, with Nazism. And yet, it has, like, managed to maintain some kind of functional democracy and some kind of open media and, at the very least, a state where journalists don't regularly get disappeared, political opponents aren't just shot in the street, and, you know, like, media isn't just, like, completely throttled with, you know, insane... I mean, Russian media, not just... I mean, now is a whole different ballgame when they've just... they're basically turning into North Korea in real time.
Mm-hmm.
But Russian media for... the past decade has essentially been like if an entire country was Fox News turned up to 11.
Right.
So, you know, there's a very real reason, apart from any kind of nationalism, that people in Ukraine are fighting not to be part of Putin's Russia. And, like, I personally, whatever other considerations, and there are plenty of other considerations around geopolitics, around war, around what level of support is appropriate, but that's kind of the basic guiding light for me, that is a very sympathetic goal that Ukrainians have.
Right. Now, two things that I'd like to enter here, and then I want to really shut up and just let you dissect the rest of the brick, okay? One thing which is brought up by J.G. Michael has joined us in our live chat room, and he thinks that it is clearly appropriate to ask you to present to my audience what it is fascism means to Russians, especially, let's see, let me read this. Let's see, in the context of the great patriotic war, etc. For many Russians, yeah. From my understanding, it means anti-Russian, something that may go over the head of Western audiences. Now, that's one thing. So put a pin in that because I'd like you to speak to that. And also, right. One of the other missing things from the reporting here, when they're talking about the different elements that have come together here in the Russian forces, you have, you know, professional soldiers. There may be mercenaries introduced here at some point, or maybe they're already there, so on and so forth. But something that I feel as though nobody's had the guts to report, although I've personally been given multiple reports about Russian speakers who have simply found themselves in the wrong place, who have now been snatched off the street directly. And guess where they are? Among the Russian soldiers now. So conscripted directly, some people that are either native or resident to Ukraine are now part of those forces as well. Now, I'm not sure if that is the smartest thing from a pragmatic standpoint to conscript people to bring them in. to literally pulverize and starve out cities in a place where they live and may have some attachment to. I'm not sure if that's the smartest thing. And it may not be happening on a massive scale, but it is happening as well. So there are conscripted individuals who have now been brought into this. So it's not only one-tenth of, according to most reports, one-tenth of Russia's standing army that is engaged in this action in a place that, again, is no larger than the size of the state of Texas for the American listener. So one-tenth of his army, apparently, is committed to this. But also, there are conscripts. There are mercenaries. So am I incorrect about this? Because I've seen nobody else with the guts to even say this, it seems like, in other media. This is the, under-the-table reports that I'm getting personally about this, that there are individuals that have disappeared simply because they might be useful, and they are Russian speakers. And, oh, by the way, one last thing. Before you tell us about the concept of fascism and the patriotic end of the idea there for a Russian individual or Russians in general, there's just one other little thing here. This idea that Russian speakers were being targeted and oppressed in Ukraine seems to not make much sense, considering the fact that the Ukrainians that I have been able to speak to, residents and people that are just native to Ukraine, who have only had about a 30-year history here of the struggle, quite honestly, to fully establish its independence as a nation. Once again, these people, as far as I can tell, and what I'm being told, is that commonly they do actually speak Russia all over Ukraine, Russian, excuse me, all over Ukraine. It is a slightly different language, a little more different than maybe the Western media is telling you, where it's like, oh, there's just a couple words different. My friend Amir has made it a great point on this show to show us that in the very basics, even in yes, hello, goodbye, these things do not sound quite similar. They have a fairly, you know, it's like it's maybe part of the same linguistic group, but it's not the same language at all. And in fact, just among Ukrainians, they were speaking Russian this whole time anyway. Not the first thing necessarily, but different situations. In certain places, they had some rules about, you know, you're supposed to do all your commerce in Ukrainian or whatever. I'm a little confused about that, but nevertheless, just common real world on the ground, this is the way it actually works. You know, you could go to a restaurant and generally you'd speak to your waiter in Russian.
Yeah, so I know all this because I don't speak Ukrainian. I speak Russian, and I've been back three times. So
there you go.
You know, somehow I was able to get around. But yeah.
Yeah, so what all I'm trying to say is it's not like if everybody that was speaking Russian in Ukraine was a target for, you know, the genocide and whatever else it is they're saying, then the whole country would be under fire at this point. And also, interesting thing when you're talking about the Jewish situation here, where, you know, how is it that these Nazis, you know, they're Nazis, and oh, they're going to target all the Jews? Well, interesting thing, because there are Jews that were living there without issues. Number one,
including the president.
That was my next point. Number two, the president is Jewish. Now, I'm not saying he's an Orthodox Jew or anything. I don't know exactly what level of practice he's in, but nevertheless, as far as I can tell, yeah, the president, the guy running the place, is Jewish. So kind of seems strange to have a Jewish Nazi running the place. Or maybe it's just me. I mean, again, you're here to educate me, sir, so I know it's a tall order, but again, fascism, this idea about frankly the conscriptions that are going on, which may not be, again, huge amounts of people, but this is happening. Nobody's reporting it. And the last thing here, which is, you know, about this, well, people who speak Russian are being targeted, and therefore, and quite frankly, if that was the case, then I might be sympathetic, again, even though I don't wish to support any action where man finds a way to justify murder, which is all that war is to me. And right. By man, I do mean mankind. That's what it is, and I do truly wish that we could evolve beyond it and get back to the spirit of the people that talked about abolishing all weapons of war and considering, you know, we breathe the same air, we're on the same planet and all that. In the 1960s, I really wish that we could go back to that thought process and that sort of zeitgeist. But in lieu of that, we do have war machines. And frankly, if it was a situation where people were being, oh, I don't know, targeted simply because of their ethnicity or the language they spoke or their religion, I am not for that and would be willing, frankly, to offer assistance to those that were being tortured, killed, and oppressed for this reason in general. But again, my preference would be no violence. But look, I'm also an adult. I know how the world works. So if you could speak to all those things, and I know that's a lot, but I have this funny feeling you're going to be able to weave all those pieces together and make a very coherent explanation of what JG asked you and what I just asked you to explain to the listener, please.
Yeah. So let me start with, like, the, I guess I'll start kind of backwards with the point that I know least about, the question of the forced conscriptions and the press gangs. I honestly, like, following the reports from the ground is very difficult at the moment because they're basically impossible to verify. It's at the level of rumors and then, you know, what you can see from the live, like, streams on Telegram and right. stuff like that. I've also heard reports of the same happening on the Ukrainian side. As you know, they did issue like a standing order to arm civilians and form civilian militias, and they're not letting any military age males out of the country. For example, my friend Sergei managed to flee from Kiev, which was under bombardment. He's in the western city of Lviv now, but he can't get out of the country because he's around my age. I think he's 35 or so. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they haven't like thrust a rifle into his hands and forced him to go to the front. I have heard some reports that kind of thing is happening. I have no idea whether it's just Russian propaganda or whatever. I'm like happy to admit what I don't know. On the Russian side, I would not be at all surprised if that was happening. Especially since, you know, starting from 2014, and during the occupation, during Russia's occupation of the Donbas region that started in 2014, many civilians went missing. Any kind of conspicuously pro-Ukrainian residents were targeted, kidnapped, beaten, disappeared. A lot of them ended up fleeing to, you know, other places in Ukraine. With that context in mind, forcible conscription doesn't seem like too much of a leap.
Right. So what you're saying is that, look, you don't have confirmation on that, but it is not something that sounds as though it's a complete fiction made up out of thin air. It's just that it may be, again, as most things are in this circumstance, a little more nuanced and also difficult to really get at once you dig through the propaganda and the inaccuracy in some cases or lack of interest by the different news agencies to really chase this down. It may be that this has happened, but we don't have the best confirmation on it. Although I will tell you that these are personal reports from people who are telling me about people that disappeared. And true, it did happen before. But again, you know, my handful of people doesn't necessarily mean a whole nation. See, that's a valid point all the way around, no matter what the report is. But either way, I would say that, yeah, so since you don't have it in hand, you're not saying, look, it's absolutely certain. And that, by the way, is a rational and sober way to examine the facts here. When we are sitting at a distance. I'm not saying this to you, Alex. You know this.
Right.
I'm just saying that this is something to be considered when you're hearing people make some very absolute statements about what they know about what's happening there. And when you start to dig through it, you got to figure out what their sources are. And in some cases, it's just an echo chamber because they've chosen to abide by the views, opinions, and alleged facts in only certain, regions of the information sphere out there on this. And because of that, they've chosen to make absolute statements based on reports that may or may not be entirely true or partially true, etc. So the point is that as we go forward through any of this, we must understand that in the, I know it's an old-timey sort of statement here, but in the fog of war, many things will be reported that might not necessarily be true or may be true or may have some truth in them, and it's going to take some time to sort out what that reality is. A good, for instance, is that situation, what was it, Snake Island, where at first there was the release of the audio and the very defiant FU to the Russian destroyers, right? This kind of thing, you'll be fired upon and all that. The initial report stated that they were dead. Then there were reports from the Russians saying that they had been captured. They are alive. It turns out that in this case, the Russians were telling the truth. But, you know, it's a little more complex than as was first presented. And this is part of just what goes on in these sorts of circumstances. But anyway, I've interrupted you enough. If that's a fair enough assessment of what you said, please continue.
Yeah, so I guess from that, actually, what I said about the sort of occupation and disappearances of pro-Ukrainian residents in the Donbas since Russia and Russian-aligned forces have occupied, that kind of goes to the next question of, like, this question of oppression of Russian speakers, right?
Yes,
so,
sir.
You know, let's go back to the years, like, from independence in 1991 through the Maidan in 2014. Like you said, the language situation in Ukraine, kind of hard to explain to outsiders, and Western media doesn't really help when they put out these maps like, oh, this side is Ukrainian speaking, this side is Russian speaking. The fact is the two languages are pretty closely related, not the same, but, you know, if people need an analogy, something like Spanish and Italian, where you can kind of understand each other if you make an effort. You can have a conversation where one person is speaking Russian and one person is speaking Ukrainian, which is, in fact, very common.
Well, I'll do you one better. I'll do you one better on that and make it even more ethnically close because of my own personal exposure. See, there's a language they call Italian. It is a construct. It is not something that, you know, people didn't speak Italian 200 years ago in Italy. They didn't. However, it is made up of three different languages. One of those languages is Sicilian, basically. And that is where my family comes from, Sicily, which is a small island off of the mainland of Italy. And a very important one as far as I'm concerned, just ethnic pride. Anyway, point is that the Sicilian language is very similar to Italian, shares some words, has a similar sort of root and all that, but indeed is not the same. So what people commonly speak as Italian today was really actually sort of encouraged and put together by a military plan where they would take people from three different regions that spoke differently in what is now called Italy. And they would put them together in units and have them teach each other the universal language. So that happened. Now, I'm not saying the history is the same, but what I'm saying is that it is that closely related that indeed Ukrainian, in my mind, could be part of what Russian is.
I mean, Ukrainians would push back against that, but they're in the same language family. Let's put it that way.
Well, I had a Ukrainian teacher on here who speaks six, seven languages, I think, and
right.
And she told me that, you know, really a lot of people present it as, well, you know, Ukrainian came from Russian, but she corrected me and said it's the other way around. That, you know, that in some ways these things came together and Ukrainian sort of like the Russian language almost sort of came from Ukrainian, but not directly. It's not a direct thing.
Kind of like, you know, humans and when people say humans came from monkeys, that's not actually true. What's true is that all of those things came from a more distant ancestor.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so Ukrainian and Russian and Belarusian all came from like an earlier East Slavic language.
Right.
So that's really the kind of diverged around like 1000 AD or so.
Right.
Diverged even more with when the Mongols invaded in around 1200. So, yeah.
Yeah. So in a similar way, back to the Italian-Sicilian issue, all of that really has a base in what we call Latin. So,
right.
And even Spanish, all of it really starts there. And all of these languages, Latin or Romance languages in one way or another, have this Latin base. But they're not necessarily directly derived from Latin, but you can still see the resonant pieces of it, just like with the Slavic languages, all sort of coming from this one base at one point. But there's not a direct A, B, C, D kind of development that one can trace here. Yet they are similar. Like to take the Slavic languages and put them in with the Latin languages doesn't make a lot of sense. But, you know, so you can see that there is definitely a deep and long ancestral tie one way or another. And it goes well beyond, you know, the time of the Soviet Union or the Russian Empire existing. But all these things were factors where Ukraine was part of this and that, these different arrangements. But still, there is a distinctly separate culture and there is a separate language. It's not
right.
Just all the same. Okay. So I just
right.
want to
so
make
then,
that very clear. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, yeah, you have these two related but not the same languages. But at the same time, because Russian was the default language of state, of public life, of commerce, of everything, during the Soviet Union, education was in Russian. Basically, all of Ukraine, virtually everyone in Ukraine does speak Russian on a native fluent level.
Mm-hmm.
Since independence, what has varied was the extent to which they choose to speak Russian and whether they choose to do so, you know, at home or in public. There are people who will use Ukrainian at home and Russian in public or vice versa, or will switch back and forth depending on how they're feeling that day. But the fact is that the broad category of quote-unquote Russian speakers would include, and, you know, this might not apply as much to some of the younger people that have been born, like, since independence, because, and, you know, you see this in a lot of countries that were formerly dominated by a larger neighbor or were part of an empire, that to preserve their language from being, from, like, basically disappearing, which, by the end of the Soviet Union, Ukrainian was in a very weak position. You know, for example, why don't I speak Ukrainian, right? My grandparents could speak it fine. My mom actually can speak it fine. I've never heard them speak it. They never bothered to because the idea was why do we need to? And they never bothered to teach it to me because, like, why would I need it? School, work, everything would be in Russian. So, you know, upon independence, Ukraine tried to reverse that by, moving education, like making schools in Ukrainian rather than in Russian, making, you know, public signs in Ukrainian rather than in Russian, or at least having both on there, public documents, and then, you know, introducing, I mean, throughout the 90s and the 2000s, most of Ukrainian television was still in Russian, right? And they tried to introduce laws to, like, okay, well, this percentage of your broadcast content has to be in Ukrainian. So this is the kind of core of the language politics in Ukraine, right? Because you can also imagine how especially if you're an older person who grew up in the Soviet Union and, you know, found yourself in now independent Ukraine, you might be annoyed at some of this, right? You might think, well, why can't I just go on speaking Russian? Why do I have to adjust to this? And, you know, there's a kind of condescension there, a cultural condescension there too, because the sort of popular view that was kind of promoted of Ukrainian was that it was not a real language, but this kind of rustic peasant dialect, you know, like kind of not just Russian spoken improperly. So, you know, there's that element too. And so, yeah, a lot of people did find this annoying. But, you know, the idea that this rises to the level of oppression is just absurd, especially when, again, the reality on the street for anyone who's ever spent like 10 minutes in any Ukrainian, in anywhere in Ukraine, even in the very West, which is like the most nationalistic, you know, Ukrainian nationalist part of Ukraine. When I went to Lviv, which is the westernmost city, like the kind of cultural capital there, I spoke Russian. There were Russian tourists. This was 2013, right before the Maidan happened. Everyone can understand in Russian. The worst thing that'll happen to you is you address them in Russian, they'll answer you in Ukrainian. So yeah, the idea that this is some kind of like genocide or oppression, when it's really like we're talking about the level, this is like a school board, an argument at a school board meeting. But of course, you know, the Russian media never really has much concern for truth, so they're able to take these kinds of little disputes and blow them up into really just call them genocide. And, you know, I think it's hard for a lot of Americans to grasp just the level of outright falsification that is there, because they're used to, well, maybe they're exaggerating a bit, but there's got to be something there, right? And I'm trying to get across just how much of a distance there is between those two.
Right.
Yeah. So, and you know, like since, and the funny thing is that Russia itself has done the most to marginalize the status of Russian in Ukraine, because since they've basically invaded, since 2014, even a lot of people who were mostly Russian speakers have like made an effort, like a patriotic effort, to switch to speaking Ukrainian. Like a lot of my friends there who I previously spoke Russian with, now we just speak English to each other. I mean, to the extent that we can, my friends there know English. Right. You know, I ended up in kind of awkward situations sometimes because, yeah, I don't know Ukrainian. And people, it's not even people would give me shit. They'd maybe like kind of like rip me a little bit. Oh, like you're speaking Russian, and you know, then I'd say, well, I can speak English to you if you prefer, but if you can't, then this is what we have to communicate in.
Okay, fair. So probably among older people more too, because I had this issue with Sicilian, because I don't speak Italian properly. I can speak Sicilian a bit, but not much, because I was only taught it as a small child. So when I do it, it sounds like a small child is speaking that way. And so some other Italian speakers here in America would be like, come on, man, you can't speak properly. No, just speak English then. You know, it's a similar thing. So the last part of this, because we're going to run right up against the hour here, believe it or not, we've gone through a whole hour, is about this idea of the patriotic issue that JG brought up. And I think it perfectly leads from where you were talking about the linguistic issue and going into this part of it. Meanwhile, we haven't even really discussed the dirty and the dirt when it comes to the invasion itself. So we'll get there in the second hour. And again, I appreciate your indulgence and patience. So how about this idea that they are the great liberators, and the patriotic aspect to this, where at the very least, from a familiar standpoint, you're talking about people that are at the very least cousins, linguistically, culturally. This is probably not an easy thing to convince a free-thinking individual that these people are the enemy. But there is this idea. So tell us about fascism and what it is that... again, difficult thing to tackle, even if you're talking about the American form of it. But let's put that in its proper context, please.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, first of all, fascism is a word that, as we know, in recent years, just in American media gets thrown around left and right to just mean anything I don't like. But the way that Russia uses fascism and Nazism specifically is a very distorted version of that, because... Yes, I mean, the Soviet Union played a massive role, if not the leading role, in defeating Nazi Germany, right? At the cost of many, many Soviet lives. You know, the Red Army liberating the concentration camps, all that. That's undeniable as a historical fact. What's also undeniable is that before... fighting against Hitler, Stalin tried to ally with him and signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, where they carved up Poland, put Stalin rounded up German communists that were hiding out in the Soviet Union and shipped them off to Hitler. And so, yeah, there was just as it's important to remember the Soviet Union's role in the defeat of Nazi Germany, it's also important to remember its role in enabling it early on. Now, so where does this go to the ideological point? The thing is that since the Soviet Union's victory in World War II, and then especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, where you no longer had the idea of communism, even, you know, no one by the 90s believed that the Soviet Union was communist, even the people who were living there. But without even that, like, pretense, Russia, post-Soviet Russia, found itself looking for a way to, like, define its national identity. And the primary way that it defined its national identity, its unifying national myth, is what they call the great victory and the victory over fascism in the Great Patriotic War. And why is this important? Is because if you look at what fascism signifies to Russia, what's the main sin of the Nazis? It wasn't that they were authoritarian. It wasn't that they targeted Jews or persecuted minorities or LGBT people. It was that they invaded Russia. Therefore, for Russia, in this national mythos, the way that they use Nazism and fascism in their national, like, dialogue, Nazism or fascism means anything that threatens Russia, anything that threatens Russia's existence and Russian values. Which is why, if you watch Russian media, if you look at the stuff that they actually put out to their domestic audience, not the sort of sanitized stuff that you get on RT or in the English version of RT. Fascism and Nazism can mean anything from, yes, the Azov Battalion in Ukraine, but also gay pride parades in Europe, or a pro-Western Ukrainian Jewish president, children's shows in Sweden that promote, that, like, do sex education. All of that is fascism and Nazism. And this is, like, very hard for, I think, a lot of Westerners, and especially, like, Western leftists who just, you know, have the... the sort of anti-fascist knee-jerk response, like, oh, well, fascism, that's bad. If they say they're against fascism, they must be good. Mm. No, Russia uses fascism to mean anything that it doesn't like, which increasingly just means, like, Western liberalism. And the fact that there's, some grain of, like, actual Nazis in this battalion sprinkled in there is... frankly, incidental to the way that Russia uses the word Nazism and fascism. Yeah. So I think that's important to understand. You know, an analogy is the way that Fox News uses socialism to mean,
anything remotely liberal.
Joe Biden to, right.
I mean, everything that could be, you know, the children's books with, you know, whatever her name was and her two mommies. Well, that's Socialism,
right.
You know, universal health care, that's socialism. It's a catch-all, and it becomes anything that is against our given alleged ethos, which is interesting here because it's a lot of liberalism here that I'm hearing is part of fascism in the Soviet mindset. And as JG pointed out in my chat room again, he's one of the most active people there typing stuff. It should never be forgotten the absolutely essential contribution from Ukrainians themselves in defeating what was Nazism, World War II. And, you know, the idea that resistance all the way to the point of starvation and a brutal winter in Stalingrad should also not be forgotten in the Nazism paradigm that's being set forth here. So we're at the end of this first hour, Alex, and I'm sorry, is there more that we should cover here before we take a little break? Because I feel like if we're listening to this for the first time, a lot to take in.
The last thing you said, just to touch on that really quick.
Please.
Yeah, and you know, because what Russia loves to harp on is that there was this Ukrainian faction that tried to use World War II as a occasion to get independence, and they collaborated with the Nazis in order to rebel against Soviet rule. It was Soviet rule. It was Stepan Bandera and the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. Didn't go well for them. The Nazis had no intention of giving Ukraine an independent state, and Stepan Bandera ended up in a Nazi prison. But you know, the Russians have to focus on that faction as a stand-in for all of Ukraine. And unfortunately, some of the extreme Ukrainian nationalists try to rehabilitate him as a national hero. But the fact is that the vast majority of Ukrainians who fought, fought within the Red Army or the partisans and fought against Nazism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the idea that Russia has tried to claim all these sort of, you know, the glory and credit of all the Soviet war dead. Well, those Soviet war dead included plenty of Ukrainians and people from the other republics. So that's just important to note, I think.
No, absolutely. And as we go forward, there's going to be a lot of things that are important to note. And is there a general place where we could go to follow up and take a look at what it is you're putting out there, what you're writing, etc.? Is there one place to go, or do we just have to look you up online?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me on Twitter. I've been posting some stuff on there. I'm trying to get more stuff out in, I'm trying to put a couple articles together. It might take a few more days, but, yeah, I'll be updating, I'll be posting updates on what I'm doing on Twitter. It's, you can just search my name on there. It's twitter.com/AchillesElbow. Just, stupid name, but like Achilles heel, but with an elbow instead.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's certainly not the worst. Yeah, it's certainly not the worst thing I've ever seen for a Twitter handle. But make sure to give it to me because I want to include that in the show notes and also get maybe some articles that you've written in the past and give people an idea. But we're going to continue with this discussion here on the Ocelli Effect because this is very important to get to some clarity, some real information, and really thoughtful perspective on this entire situation. And I'm sorry, I'm not looking to fall in line with the American propaganda state. I'm not looking to fall in line with RT. I'm not looking to get in line with those that are entertained by warfare and bloodshed. Okay, it bleeds, it leads, I get it. And there is profit to be made there, but I'm not doing it. The Ocelli Effect will continue with our very special guest after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
the Ocelli Effect calls in to the Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and JP Sicilian and all of the guests that you have how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone. I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have no idea.
Thanks. And most of our fans just send email and death threats.
Ocelli.com.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
In the beginning, always overpowered the evils of all man's sin. But in times, nations grew weak and our sins felt love, while evils were strong. In the depths of hell, in the blackest of hate, the fear awaits you. Now, many lifetimes later, they destroy, beaten down. Only the corpse rebels, rashes of dreams, and blood stains. Let those who have the future. So come now, children of the beast, be strong and shout at the devil.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Ocelli.com.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now here at Ocelli.com. But, of course, you could be listening some other time, some other place, and some other way. No matter what, where you are, when you are, who you are, welcome. Alex Gendler is discussing this entire horrible situation. Sorry, it still sits that way with me. And, yeah, it does sound a little mainstream media-ish. But, look, I can't argue with their propaganda when their propaganda strikes the right chord in my heart. I absolutely despise the fact that this is going on. I think innocent people, no matter how you feel about them, there are plenty of innocent people that are going to lose their lives, and this happens far too often in this place we call Earth. On this place we call Earth, among the people we call people, among the human family, which I consider us all to be one race and, quite frankly, all on the same great boat or rock floating out there in space. We're all here together, and when we set to killing each other, I'm sorry, I object. And I'm actually not sorry. It's just the only thing I can do. Anyway, besides that, we're getting to a lot of the facts and a lot of the nuances in this situation that is the Ukrainian conflict at the moment. Is it war? Sure, it looks like that to some people on the ground. Are there refugees? Is there things going on? We're going to get into some of that in this hour. The actual invasion itself, now that all of the context has been set with Alex in the first hour. And that means I'm going to shut up. and try not to ask so many questions, but, you know, despite my best efforts, it's still going to happen. But, Alex, I really appreciate you doing this with me, and I'm going to give you the listener Alex's Twitter handle, and quite frankly, the way this conversation has gone, I really hope that you'll be friendly to the idea of doing some more of this in the future, and maybe not just about Ukraine, but other things as well. So anyway, Alex, thanks for doing this and coming into the second hour. Where should we take it now that we've laid out a lot of context, a lot of history, one way or another, to give people an idea about the things that, again, I say were not properly represented in Western media, for sure, and we're certainly not being represented in any sort of realistic way in a place they call Russia, which, quite frankly, now, you know, we're getting reports of you can do 15 years for just saying it's a war. Right. You know, I mean, I know I'm oversimplifying, but, you know, journalists do get killed in war zones. Things like that happen. But it might happen a little more often if you're in, I don't know, Putin's war zones. Anyway, maybe it's just me and my prejudice, Alex. I don't know. I don't think so. That's a bit of a facetious statement. But anyway, where should we go from here if we're examining this and we're looking at it emerge and we're getting the live reports and you know, frankly, what is it that is not being said elsewhere, and what is it we're being misled about here? A speaker like you, a thoughtful person, a journalist, I think might have a way to guide us. So by all means, go ahead, sir.
Thanks, Chuck. Yeah, again, I appreciate being here. Thanks for everything you said. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously so much here to talk about. And I think we covered a lot of really important stuff in the first half. And, you know, I don't want... The frustrating thing about this is that there's so much to talk about, and yet I think even just the baseline, people's baseline perceptions of this thing have been so shaped by just straight up Russian propaganda on the one side, and then B, and then there is now this sort of, as the kids say, cringe, like the kind of stuff you see in the mainstream media where there are, you know, comparing Zelensky to like Marvel superheroes or whatever. That stuff is not helpful to understanding the conflict. It really just oversimplifies it. There's a lot of places we could go. I think it might be helpful to talk a bit more about the Maidan, the sort of the demonstrations that started in late 2013 and went through 2014 and ended up,
hang on, Alex, wait one second, because some people might not even understand the very baseline of where you're about to go. So I'd like you to again, remember that, we as listeners to you, all of us, me including, included with the listeners, might not fully understand. You say Maidan. I'm not sure necessarily what you're talking about. I mean, I actually am, but unless you're paying very close attention, you might not even be aware of what that means. Is it a region? Is it, you know?
Right.
So if you could go real basic on this to get rolling. And secondly, just a sort of additional throw-in comment. I got to be honest, I'm a little guilty of looking at Zelensky right now and saying, well, if nothing else, this guy's got balls. And he is literally sitting there saying, look, I'm not leaving. I'm not fleeing. I'm not going to be the government in exile. And I'm not sure if it's, again, the nature of propaganda so much as the reality. But, you know, a guy who says basically, look, I know that they probably want to kill me and I'm staying is admirable to me. You know, maybe I'm being
absolutely
fed the line,
but... I'm not trying to diminish him.
I'm not contradicting you. I'm just saying that maybe I'm guilty of, you know, I mean, I'm not going for the whole, hey, is he Spider-Man or whatever it is they're doing there. But I mean, but the thing is, you got to admit that, I mean, when I look at people that are, you know, the American politicians who are allegedly representing us, I don't think too many of them. I mean, you know, Ted Cruz ran away when it got cold. You know, people that might be targets for assassination could tend to run away and hide a little more. And you almost can't blame him, but this guy's not doing that. So maybe I'm guilty of having my sentimental buttons pushed with the guy a little bit because of what they're presenting. But still, I can't deny he's still there, and he's still talking like he wants to fix this and stand with his people, which is, again, hell of a lot more than I think I'd get from most American politicians. So, but putting that aside, please help us understand this, what you're about to go into from the very basics.
Right. So, yeah, let's talk about the Euromaidan, as it was called. So basically, again, yeah, we can start, you know, with since independence in 1991 through like the next two decades, basically, Ukraine, you know, it went through the same sort of painful privatization of formerly, you know, Soviet assets as Russia did. The 90s were a terrible time, like living standards, the whole economy just was completely in shambles, living standards dropped. And, you know, a lot of most of the money and the political power ended up in the hands of these oligarchs who were either former Soviet officials or, you know, people from the criminal underworld who managed to get their hands on this privatization. And, you know, like in Russia, those oligarchs were eventually what Putin did after the 90s was purge the disloyal ones and consolidate the rest of them into like a single loyal faction. So the oligarchs still control Russia, but now there's only they're not competing oligarch factions. They're all loyal to Putin. Whereas in Ukraine, you just kept having competing oligarch factions that were clans, they call them, that funded different political parties. And some of those and basically coalesced around like pro-Russia parties and pro-Ukraine, both Ukrainian nationalist and like pro-Western, pro-EU parties. And power really just kind of kept getting passed back and forth between these factions while really corruption persisted and few things actually improved for ordinary people. But, you know, given this, and there is sort of a pox on both houses stance to take here, which is completely valid. But the fact is, given the frankly, like, not great choices that people had, what people were still doing, what ordinary people were still doing was, you know, just looking at the basic facts of what's life like in Russia and what's life like in the West. And they were making their choice. And, you know, increasingly since from like 2004, when you had sort of a popular demonstrations that against the kind of rigged election. From 2004, you saw this big push, and it wasn't just the elites, and it wasn't just, you know, it was led by like the professional middle classes. Like a lot of protests are, you know, that's familiar here in the US too. But there was a general consensus that Ukraine should move away from this like kleptocratic thug regime that is Russia, which because Ukrainian media remained relatively free because you didn't have it consolidated around this like single centralized oligarch faction. But there were, you know, when you have multiple competing bastards, at least you're able to get like multiple sides of what might be the truth. Mm. So, yeah, people had a good idea of what life was like in Russia and that they didn't want to go down that path. And that the only other path available to them was to try to join the West and the EU. Whether that was, you know, naive of them to think that the EU would admit them or not, that was a legitimate, like, democratic desire on the part of the people. And what was happening in the early 2010s was that they had a president who was sort of trying to walk a line between both. He was sort of flirting with Russia, trying to get a good deal on gas and kind of economic aid from them, while also making a public show of signing agreements with the EU and putting Ukraine on the path towards EU membership.
Now, this is the guy, Alex, just to be clear, this is the guy who we've recently seen on television coming out with body armor on and saying, look, the reason why the Ukrainian military is able to resist Russia right now is because I built it. That guy is who you're talking about, right? Who was just previous to Zelensky here?
Yeah, no. I'm talking about Viktor Yanukovych, who was president from 2010 to 2014. He was widely seen as a pro-Russian president, although he did what did him in was that he promised to lead Ukraine into the EU while still trying to maintain friendly relations with Russia. And what happened was when he was about to sign this association agreement with the EU that he had promised the people, which was like largely supported by the Ukrainian population, he suddenly was summoned to Moscow for an emergency like meeting and came back and torpedoed the agreement completely because, you know, Putin offered him they say it's because Putin offered him a better deal, but also because Putin gave him an ultimatum. And that was really the last straw for a lot of Ukrainians. And at that point, it became not just about joining the EU, but just about the, like, how stupid do you think we are that, you know, you have just shown yourself to be like a Russian puppet. Like, we have that you're admitting that Ukraine has no sovereignty because this decision that you were elected under and promised the people can just be completely canceled out with a snap of Putin's fingers, right?
Right.
That was what really pissed people off.
Right. Now, and then there's this other guy, I guess, came after him in between him and Zelensky?
Yeah, yeah. I'll get to that.
Okay, sorry.
But, yeah, so it started off with some small protests, mostly students and kind of middle-class professionals. It eventually escalated when people saw the sort of riot police, you know, being violent and beating the students. That pissed people off even more. So more people came out, like, you know, that then the parents came out and like the army veterans. And then, you know, it might have even petered out, but Yanukovych again followed a directive from Putin. He tried to pass these like draconian anti-protest laws of the kind you see in Russia. He tried to ram those through the parliament, and then the protests just completely like snowballed, and, you know, like half of Kiev's population was out in the streets at a certain point. You know, the thing is that this was largely, you know, similar to something like Occupy Wall Street. It was largely like a democratic movement that was made up of all sorts of political factions. There wasn't really much like ideological coherence there, other than we want democracy, we're against corruption, and we want Yanukovych gone, and we don't want to be a Russian-controlled puppet state. The more violent things got with the cops, the more you saw the emergence of the far right kind of like Ukrainian nationalists. Because guess what? Those kinds of guys love. They love violence. They love a chance to. They love a chance to get into a fight. Mm-hmm. They were never more than like a fraction of the people there. But again, once the violence got underway, they did represent. They played an outsized role when, because those are the guys who you wanted fighting the cops, basically. That's the sort of kernel. Of course, the Russian propaganda loved that and sees that like, oh, this is a neo-Nazi protest, like the whole thing, right? But no, yeah, the goals were largely, as I said, it was a popular democratic protest against being a Russian puppet state. Not, by the way, like anti-Russian or anti-Russian people or anti-Russian language. It eventually resulted in Yanukovych being toppled. By the way, a lot of people have made a lot of the role of, you know, trying to say this was a CIA or NATO engineered, you know, like AstroTurf protest. Like, no, I had friends on that square. It was massive. It was unexpected. The U.S. establishment was not looking to undermine stability in Ukraine at that moment. They had plenty of other things going on that they were trying to deal with, and this was an unwelcome kind of distraction for them. Of course, once the protests were underway and it was like this big crisis, of course the U.S. is going to stick their nose into it, and, you know, you had diplomats from the U.S. flying in and declaring their support for democracy like they do everywhere. That's neither surprising nor some kind of indication that they planned the whole thing. What U.S. and EU diplomats tried to do was they tried to get the protesters to come to the leaders of the protests to come to some kind of agreement with Yanukovych where He'd like serve out, you know, another year of his term, and then he'd step down, and so on and so forth. And that, when that was about to be decided, the protesters weren't having it. Like, the masses of the people would not go home, and Yanukovych ended up having to flee. And at that point, you know, the Ukraine like reorganized its parliament. They had new elections, and they elected. First, they had Yatsenyuk as prime minister. Then they elected the first presidential election after the Maidan, elected Poroshenko, who was this kind of he wasn't a far right nationalist, but he did lean more towards the nationalist side. So that was basically the culmination of what was called the Euromaidan, right? And the Euromaidan, because it was a protest that was sparked by the entry into the EU. Now, notice, like, what this all started over was the EU, right? There was no talk of joining NATO, as which Russia now claims is one of its main causes for war. Mm-hmm. In fact, as of when the Maidan happened, the majority of the Ukrainian population was opposed to joining NATO. It had something like 30% support. And in fact, all of the kind of Russian propaganda that you were seeing in Russian media against the Maidan and that movement, was they weren't even talking about NATO at that point. Their talking points at that point were, you know, the EU is this decadent Western liberal state. If Ukraine joins the EU, they're gonna, you know, they just want Ukraine to join because they want a fresh source of children to traffic to their pedo elites. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of thing. So,
well, what should be noted here, Alex, in this entire story you're telling us, getting from you know, the Maidan situation to Zelensky's election and all that. Right. I just want to provide the counter, the contrast here as far as what Western media did with all this, which is, you know, one way or another, look, here's a corrupt nation that, you know, is allowing bad things to happen, so on and so forth. And the fact is, again, it's a lot more nuanced. You have things in motion where the people, big note here, the people are participating in asserting their will. Now, maybe that wasn't the prettiest and most streamlined thing to happen here, but they put a guy in, they think he's going to do the right thing, he doesn't, now they want to remove him. I mean, again, I'm oversimplifying, but it's a completely different story than what was pushed by the right wing here and the left wing over this time, where it's like, look, there's all this corruption, this is a totally dysfunctional state, you know, and these are... I mean, whether you were Trump saying, oh, it was all this corruption and we just wanted him to reveal, blah, 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 and we know that story. Or it was the left wing talking about what it is they needed to do. And during Obama's administration, not being very effective as far as assisting in the right way. If you wanted to promote a democratic sort of process here and encourage them to continue to assert their independence, even as just sort of a supporter of that, not an effective job being done. And our media misrepresented this as, look, this is just another, you know, messy, you know, failing regime and all that, which I think was an unfair and oversimplified characterization of something that was organically happening, that the people were literally changing their representation, their leadership, in real time as best they could. And look, again, it's a nation that's only really had 30 years of its own identity, you know, in its representation, in its leadership. And again, you could argue that sometimes they had puppets or whatever, but the thing is that when it did happen, they pushed back, they were able to. So that's something that's often lost here. They weren't just simply shut down. You know, the media wasn't entirely cut off from the rest of the world. Some of that sloppy process was shown to us, misrepresented, but still shown to us because it was actually happening. Is that not an important point, or am I misunderstanding this?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. I mean, and this is like the thing that gets lost, because I think people people on both the left and the right. And I mean, for the left, I think it's a sort of trying to cope with the fact that I say we because I can still consider myself part of the left, that we don't have power to really affect events anymore. And then people start playing this, like, you know, geopolitical strategist in their head, you know, about decisions that really they have no bearing on, right? But it's like you view the game as this, like, board game of risk, and that you're like, pretend that you can, like, you know, map the dynamics and make decisions there. So, you know, people, and what really the result of that kind of perspective is this assumption that kind of like people have no agency, right? If there's a protest in Russia or in like in Venezuela or in like a place that's not friendly to the US, it must be a CIA psyop, right? It must be like a CIA planned thing. And similarly, you know, the right wing will say that, you know, protests in the US are like, you know, fueled by Russian or Chinese Russian misinformation, or they're like funded by China. And it's this common thing of just like denying the idea of popular agency, which to me is just like, if there's anything worth believing in, it's popular agency, because otherwise, why do you even care about politics, right?
Exactly.
Otherwise, it's just a spectator sport between some great powers that we have no way of affecting.
Exactly. So with all that in mind, though, you know, I want you to continue on, because we're about to get to, okay, you have this time period where Zelensky's going to come in. And he's significant in that he was, well, you know, what are you going to say? The people that want to scoff, yeah, and say, well, a reality TV show guy got on, well, hello, welcome to America, because, right, you know, yeah. I mean, I'm just saying, it's just one of those points I like to make, is that we just had a reality show TV president, okay? So calm down with scoffing at others who did that.
Right.
And any, I don't know. Anyway, please continue on, enough from me.
Yeah, and so the thing was like that, you know, so this happened, it was this triumphal moment for, right, like, oh, the people asserted their will, but Russia wasn't just going to let that slide, right? And Russia basically punished Ukraine for, because, and, you know, we can talk about whether NATO played a role in provoking Russia, which I think they frankly did in 2008. That was one thing I forgot to mention today. I think, regardless of what people think of NATO, and I mean, I happen to think that, yes, NATO is a has been a pretty terrible force in the world. Also, at the same time, from the perspectives of people who live next to Russia, from Russia's neighboring countries, they have very good reasons to want NATO in their backyard and to want to be part of NATO, because, frankly, that's their only, in the lack of a actual functioning international system, and, you know, Russia holding a veto on the UN Security Council, NATO has been the only thing that protects them from Russian domination, which Russia has proven more than willing to extend over its satellite states, or what it considers its satellite states. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not cheering for NATO here, but it's ridiculous to not see the very real reasons that people over there have for supporting it. And, you know, we're not in a position to give them the left is not in a position to give them a better option. So I just wanted to mention that. But I do think that whatever you think of NATO, in 2008, they made a massive strategic blunder where they basically announced that they were at some point going to admit Ukraine and Georgia, which is another, you know, neighbor country that neighbors Russia in the Caucasus Mountains, which they knew was going to piss Russia off. Russia had, you know, expressed its hostility to that many times. Whether or not you think, and yeah, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that Russia has no right to dictate the foreign affairs of its neighbors. They're sovereign states, right? We ended the Soviet Union. It's done. Let it go. But on a realistic sense, we know that that's their position, right or wrong. And so NATO kind of just announcing this thing that they knew was going to antagonize them, and then not really implementing any kind of security guarantees or anything in the meantime, just basically leaving it open. I think that was a massive blunder. Whether or not this would have happened regardless is kind of, you know, I can't answer counterfactual history, right? So, you know, moving away from that, the thing is, Russia responded to this, but I think what really was the more immediate thing besides NATO was a leader like Putin does not like to see popular uprisings in neighboring countries. I literally, Putin does not like to see popular uprisings that actually overthrow a corrupt, kleptocratic president and make him flee the country. That strikes a bit too close to home, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was to just punish Ukraine for that, so that no other, so that other places, that especially the people back home in Moscow, in Russia, who might be thinking about it, think twice. So immediately, Russia seized the Crimean Peninsula, where it already had a naval base that it was like leasing from Ukraine. And then it started funding, not just funding, but directly, directly like fomenting this separatist, this separatist movement in the eastern regions that were, you know, as I said, virtually all of Ukraine was Russian speaking. The eastern regions were more likely to be exclusively Russian speaking. There was much less of a hold of you know, Ukrainian language and culture there.
Mm-hmm.
For reasons like you know, the Ukrainian famine and Russia moving people there during during Soviet rule, but you know, we don't have to go into that. The point is that there was very little support on the ground in eastern Ukraine for this kind of like separatism based on what we already talked about, these like extremely exaggerated, exaggerated if not just completely made up,
mm-hmm.
Narratives of oppression and genocide of Russian speakers. And so there was very little support on the ground for that. At first, I think Russia tried to sort of go for plausible deniability and pretend that these were like local uprisings by you know, pro-Russian Ukrainians, but those really failed to get off the ground. There was like some AstroTurf protests that were just like mostly like sad-looking pensioners holding signs that were clearly like, you know, paid to be there or bust in. And then, you know, then they sent in actual militias that were, and this is all like a matter of public record, the militias that were that like started this whole separatist thing were usually led by Russian army officers and or former, you know, quote, supposedly former or retired Russian army officials. And yeah, so that was, you know, the sort of message there was that if you try to exert your popular will in opposition to what Russia wants, you're going to be punished. And, you know, we already talked about how these militias, they basically established like what amounts to warlord rule, you know, like suppressed any pro-Ukrainian residents. And, you know, Poroshenko, who was the president, the newly elected president, he did what, you know, now in retrospect, it's debated how wise this was, but he did what probably most presidents of a country do, you know, a neighboring power basically invades your territory under very thin pretext of trying to claim it's a local uprising. They were literally, Russians were literally sending their own tanks in there. What one thing they were doing was like pretending to abandon them at the border, and then you know, their own like quote unquote volunteers would steal the tank, the Russian tanks that had been conveniently abandoned at the border, and drive them in.
Well, simultaneously, so, you know, they were displacing people too.
Yes.
You know, I knew that there were people that lived further east, lost their homes, basically get out.
Right.
This is now, you know, a Russian sympathetic area, whatever it is they called it. I'm not sure, but
yeah,
frankly,
Donetsk People's Republic, yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just saying that there was not only the impact as far as, you know, movement of military assets under different guises, but there was also a on-the-ground thing where you could lose your home. You could be forced to move. And again, one of the guys that I've had on this show a few times was a resident there. Frankly, long history. You know, he was originally from what I'll just call Yugoslavia, okay? And then spent a great deal of his childhood in Australia, and then wound up settling there in Ukraine to a few years later be displaced along with his wife. You know, and look, I'm not saying that his story is everybody's story, but what I'm saying
is... No, that guy doesn't have the best luck of where he ends up.
No, Emir, he's a great guy and everything, and I really, I worry for him and pray for him every night, actually. You know, as we speak, and he may be listening indeed. But the thing is that there's a lot of aspects to this, and I know we've only got about 18 minutes left with you, you know, for what we scheduled, but by all means, take as much time as you wish and tell us the rest of this, because we've got to bring it up to today. And
yeah, let me do that quickly. Yeah, because I know I've been so. Basically, what Poroshenko did as president of Ukraine was launch a military operation to try to drive out these separatists and take back control over over the Donbas, the eastern Ukraine region.
Right.
And for the first few months, it looked like they were going to do it. These were like ragtag militias that were led by like weird extremists, like which I already listed, like a lot of fascists and. Both like the, you know, the sort of fascists we're familiar with, and a lot of people who were like historical reenactors who wanted to like restore the Russian Empire, the Tsar, like the White Army, just a lot of like really weird reactionary elements. But, you know, when they were on the verge of losing, Russia would just send in more equipment and more volunteers. And I mean, they were sort of like stealth conscripting people, not through the official army, but basically as like mercenaries and sending them in there. So it became apparent that Russia was not going to let these separatist statelets lose, just like they did, you know, in Georgia with South Ossetia. They did it in Moldova and Transnistria back in the 90s. You know, and Ukraine's army was not that well organized, and it did include these, like, you know, as we've talked about before, these like far right Nazi battalions along with normal, you know, Ukrainian military forces. So I'm not going to defend Poroshenko. I think that that military operation was not conducted as like carefully as it could have, if it should have been conducted at all. And, you know, there was shelling back and forth. Civilians were displaced. People had their houses destroyed. And frankly, a lot of the population that, probably wasn't that sympathetic to the kind of like separatist occupation ended up also resenting the Ukrainian government because their house got hit by a shell. So, you know, this is really the reality on the ground. This is what Russia has portrayed this as just like a completely unmotivated ethnic cleansing of Russians by the Ukrainian government, which I hope I've, while not apologizing for it, I hope I've illustrated this as, you know, this was a military response to a foreign-backed, not just foreign-backed, but literally Russian forces in Ukraine trying to declare this like separatist region, mm-hmm. which I unfortunately, you know, for better or for worse, this is how any state, any nation would respond, right? So yeah, you know, that basically ground to a standstill. And when they had their new election recently, I think it was 2019 that Zelensky was elected. But yeah, Zelensky ran, and he's a very interesting figure because he was a comedian whose claim to fame was he played a history teacher who accidentally, you know, who gets filmed going on this anti-corruption rant and gets like elected as president of Ukraine in the show, and becomes this kind of comical everyman trying to fix this broken, corrupt system figure. And then he ran basically on that platform in real life. And the interesting thing to note was, in contrast to Poroshenko, who was basically a Ukrainian nationalist, Zelensky was Jewish. He was a Russian speaker. He was from the eastern regions that were mostly Russian speaking. He, you know, he switched to speaking Ukrainian when he was running as a show of like patriotism, but it was very noticeable that he struggled, you know, when he spoke Ukrainian. So he was definitely like a protest vote of people who, you know, they wanted peace. They wanted like some kind of sensible solution to the conflict. And they rejected this kind of hardline nationalism.
Interesting note about him, too, is that, quite frankly, he was well vested as somebody who made his money, his career in the Russian speaking world. Is somebody who had a great investment there, who maybe didn't right. necessarily want to, for his own personal reasons, not want to take an anti-Russian stance per se, but was in his own way being a patriotic Ukrainian. So I mean, there's something to be said there, where there was a bit of, like, you know, having your having your ethos above your pocketbook, so to speak, right? Your wallet. And I think that's interesting just personally due to the fact that it's like a politician who comes in and, yeah, he's part of a fictional world and then sort of, you know, recreates it in real life. That's interesting in and of itself, Alex. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely right. I mean, you know, there's speculation. He has ties to oligarchs because it's basically impossible in Ukraine to operate otherwise. So, I wouldn't want to overstate his like selflessness in doing this. But regardless of what his own personal motives, the message that and the platform that he ran on resonated with a lot of Ukrainians who, and the vision of Ukraine that he was promoting was a like a multi-ethnic one that included Russian speakers. Frankly, yeah, Poroshenko, who was running for re-election, he and his people ran like a borderline anti-Semitic campaign against Zelensky, and also implying that, you know, he wasn't trustworthy because he's too close to Russia. He might betray the country. And, you know, they roundly lost. Like, Zelensky was elected by a large margin. So, you know, there was this optimism. But I think this definitively showed that Russia wasn't really interested in compromise, because as soon as he was elected, Russia just started running their old same script, whether it made sense or not, that Zelensky is a Nazi Western puppet. Even though he ran, they basically reran the same script that they were saying about Poroshenko, even though Zelensky had run against Poroshenko on a peace platform. Mm. So that's, you know, and then Zelensky has now been basically forced to be a war president, even though he ran as a peace candidate,
right?
Because he wasn't the one who chose to start the war. So that's that, you know, that's how we got to where we are today, basically.
Well, a weird thing about that, too, is in the propaganda against Zelensky during the time of the action, you know, the military operation, as they're calling it, the one thing I can't seem to find the providence for, the origin for, is this claim that, you know, everybody's, that he's like a cocaine addict. That's the only weird thing I haven't been able to find, like, where that came from at all. Do you know where that assertion came from? Because somebody told me, and it's the only assertion I've gotten from anybody to try and explain it, is that, well, he was an entertainer, so cocaine, of course. I don't quite,
right.
Yeah. Is that it, or am I off?
I mean, first of all, Russia calls everybody drug addicts. That's part of their whole thing, along with Nazism, you know, like decadent, degenerate Westerners, you know, doing cocaine and all that. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, he was in show business. So obviously, very, very plausible. Completely irrelevant. Also, I mean, hey, I can't imagine how long he's like staying up, you know, doing like war planning and talks. If he needs a bump to get him through those, you know, by all means.
At this point, look, I hear you. At this point, I mean, if he needs a little coke to stay awake, who's going to deny him if he's dealing with all this? I'm saying that flippantly. But, I mean, honestly, I just didn't understand where the propaganda came from. But you're saying this is just common. This is all there is to it. You know, obviously, if you're on the extreme right in America, anybody who's opposition to you is somehow connected to pedophilia and, you know, and is about the destruction of the culture one way or another. It's like just part of the package that comes along with it. The whole
thing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, basically. Yeah,
okay, it's, fair enough. Okay, so with the last, you know, 10 minutes or so, again, you can take any time you want here, but, I mean, what should we understand about this conflict here, which, again, is being represented in a certain way in the West, is clearly being represented by, you know, Putin's media, and I'm just going to call it what it is, the state-run media there. Obviously, there's only a particular way it can be represented, and they are the great liberators, etc. You know, how do we parse out what the reality of what's happening is now? And really, I'd like to reserve the right to bring you back at some point. I'm also told that you and I could have an interesting discussion about the black metal bands that might have something to do with this Azov Battalion and all that. I am a heavy metal guy, just so you know. Used to be a death metal singer myself. So, you know, and not a black metal singer, but a death metal singer. Difference. Anyway, point is that there's a lot more that we could discuss about this, and we've really only scratched the surface with you. My apologies for interrupting as much as I have, but clarity is one of those things I'm reaching for with you, so I have to make sure that I'm understanding all of what it is you're talking about. So what should we leave people with here regarding the current conflict and how they're supposed to digest this? Because I'm just, I am sickened by it just because it is a conflict of this nature. I am certainly detesting it based on the fact that innocent people will be one way or another killed, harmed, displaced. It's happening. Refugees, I like to see none of this, and I don't care where it is, you know, but nevertheless, how is it that we are supposed to interpret what is coming? And, you know, quite frankly, even this idiocy in this country where I feel like the American public is being held sort of superficially hostage, we're being told, you know, well, we can't send our sons and daughters into harm's way. So what you're going to have to do is pay for it with this, you know, crush of inflation, even though the truth is more like that crush of inflation was coming anyway, and it's got yep. nothing to do with this. But anyway, propaganda in the U.S., yep. propaganda everywhere, and not a drop of truth to drink sometimes. Let's get to it. How is it that we should interpret what it is we're seeing and the reality of it, in your opinion, Alex? And again, I'll give you guys, he is on Twitter at, just really quickly here, at Achilles Elbow. I like that, by the way. I know you think it might be a little silly in retrospect, but Achilles yeah. Elbow, I love it. So if you go on Twitter and search for Achilles Elbow, you'll find Alex. But also there is a alexgendler.com. So I'm going to give you guys the links to in the show notes to that. And I think that this is a guy we need to pay attention to. He has a historical context and also a journalistic and intelligent viewpoint of all this stuff, which, quite frankly, a lot of us might be subject to following our emotions a little more often than we should regarding this. And I really challenge everyone at all times to reexamine everything, especially what you're being told, because I'm one of these people who has difficulty trusting any of the alleged sources when it comes to this sort of thing. And we need people to analyze it properly and give us a real-world perspective on some things that are going to be made unreal in many media circles in the English-speaking world. So, Alex, again, I'm sorry, but please go ahead and tie a bow on this, so to speak, and take as much time as you need. But if you want to get down to the last, you know, time that we had laid out here, you got about 6 minutes, but...
I'll do my best.
You go ahead and do it your way, brother, and yeah. I will put it out exactly as you lay it down. Go ahead.
So yeah, I mean, just to tie it up, like, so the question that a lot of people have and a lot of people have asked me and are asking themselves is like, what can we do? And I think we just need to, like, bluntly and brutally answer that with, like, frankly, not much. Because there is one part, there is the party that is driving this, the party that decided to start this war, the party that is moving it forward, is Russia. And there's really no power that we have, that we, you know, the listeners, the West, people in the West, whether you're on the left or the right, whatever, really no power that we have over Russia and what, and Putin and what they decide to do and what can make them decide to stop this. Who can affect them? I mean, the Ukrainians, like, just astoundingly, I mean, again, yeah, I don't want to do hero worship, but this is, you know, this is the classic image of resistance, like, heavily outnumbered, massive, at least from everyone I've talked to on the ground there, massive support from the public for this, like, heavily outgunned military defending against, like, a, you know, the second largest military in the world. And, you know, there's just not much we can do because, and, you know, we've all seen the calls for a no-fly zone going around, right? And a lot of those are coming from people in Ukraine, and including some of my friends. And I will not, like, you know, spit on those calls or condemn them, because I completely understand that, you know, they have very good reason to want to do everything possible to resist Russian invasion and avoid Russian occupation, because we've seen what Russia does to places it occupies. We're already seeing it in Ukraine. We saw what they did to Grozny in Chechnya. So, you know, I don't think it's at the same time, we in the West know what those of us who know what a no-fly zone entails. You know, it's not a magical force field. It's shooting down. It's active war. It's shooting down Russian planes. Right. And that understandably would lead to escalation. And so I personally am not going to support those calls, but I completely understand where they're coming from. So, and, you know, and if that might not seem like a very satisfying answer, but again, it just underscores, like, yeah, what can we do? Not much. The only thing that really I would feel comfortable advocating people do is, as much as you can, donate to humanitarian organizations and directly to people who are on the ground in Ukraine trying to, you know, evacuate people, trying to get like people's medical needs met. I can drop a couple of those links for you if you want. You know, it's hard to sift through because there's so many of them.
Yeah, if you could provide us with some solid ways to actually do some good, I'd be all for that. But I see, you know, as per usual, when something like this happens, there's always a lot of organizations that come out, and I'm never quite certain about where the money's actually going. But I would be more than happy to promote something that that maybe you've done a little research on and you're sure is going to have a positive effect. So absolutely, please do, when we're done talking, give me some of those and I'll include them with the show notes and in the chat room at ochelli.com.
Great. Yeah, and I mean, besides that, right, like the only, honestly, the people who have the most control over this, who can stop this, are the Russian people. And especially, like, I mean, if you want to talk about bravery, we've talked about the Ukrainian resistance, but you should also definitely give like solidarity to the people in Russia who have been arrested by the thousands, who are protesting the war, knowing that, you know, this isn't like going to a protest in the US or in the West where, you know, you'll get like, you get social media clout and maybe a cop pushes you. But like, this is, you know, people are getting 15 years in jail, they're getting disappeared, and they're still coming out to protest the war. So, you know, the only hope, the only hope right now for this, I think, is that, you know, the Russian military gets bogged down, and this, and, you know, especially given all the sanctions that are happening, that people at home begin to realize, what the hell are we doing, and, you know, just overthrow this regime. But there's very little we can do directly to make that happen. So, you know, that's the sort of depressing kind of note to end on. But it's true, because, frankly, I think until there's an active international anti-war movement and movement, you know, in some kind of international movement to, like, move humanity forward, I don't think we are going to keep seeing more stuff like this, and we're just going to be relegated to, like, being cheerleaders on the sideline for one side or the other. And yeah, that's that.
Well, again, I want to thank JG Michael for putting me in touch with you. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to bug you to bring you back on very soon to follow up on this discussion. I want to see how people receive it. For sure, and I know it's going to get me a lot of complaints and so on, because quite frankly, there are a lot of opinions being offered out there for people to parrot, and I'm not going with that, and neither is Alex Gendler. Again, Achilles Elbow on Twitter and alexgendler.com. I'll give you those in the show notes and all that. They're already in the chat room at ochelli.com. Alex, I need to thank you as well for taking the time and putting up with me as I've asked my questions and made my assertions and let you break them down any which way you wanted. I appreciate you, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyway, guys, that is the end of the regular Ocelli Effect. I might just actually do an extra segment here because might want to wrap this up myself, and we'll see. Stick around to the live stream and find out. Meanwhile, if you're listening to the podcast, that's that. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.